Chapter 6. The Portsmouth night coach was an almost entirely naval concern, apart from the horses and one of the inside passengers, an elderly lady. The coachman had been in Lord Rodney's household, the guard was a former marine, and all the passengers belonged to the present navy in one way or another. When the stars were beginning to fade in the east, the machine ran past some dim houses and a church on the right-hand side of the road, and the elderly lady said, "It will be Petersfield in a few minutes. I hope I've forgot nothing." She counted her parcels over again and then said to Stephen, "So I am not to buy, sir? That is your firm opinion?"
"Madam," replied Stephen, "I repeat that I know nothing of the Stock Exchange. I couldn't readily distinguish between a bull and a bear. I only say that if your friend's advice is based upon their persuasion that peace is to be concluded within the next few days, then you should perhaps reflect that they may be mistaken."
"And yet they are very knowing, well-informed gentlemen. And then you, too, sir, you may be mistaken, may you not?"
"To be sure, ma'am, I am as fallible as my neighbour, perhaps even more so, indeed."
The guard blew a fine blast, imitated by most of the younger outside passengers, for whom an English spring night on the top of a coach was nothing in comparison with a night on the billows of Brest.
"Then that is settled," said the lady. "I shall certainly not buy. How glad I am that I asked of your opinion. Thank you, sir."
The coach wheeled into the yard of the Crown to change horses, and when the passengers who had been stretching their legs during the operation came aboard again, Stephen said to the coachman, "You will never forget to set me down at Bureton, I'm sure, and if you could do so at the little small alehouse rather than the crossroads, it would save me the weary walk. Here's a 3-shilling piece."
"Thank you, my lord," said the coachman. "The alehouse it is."
"I'm convinced you were right, sir, in advising the gentlewoman not to buy," said one of the insides, an accountant at the dockyard, when Petersfield was behind them. "It doesn't appear to me that there's any real likelihood of peace at present."
"I should think not," said a tall, awkward midshipman, who had spent much of the night kicking the other passengers, not from vice or wantonness, but because every time he went to sleep his long legs gave convulsive jerks, entirely of their own accord.
"I should think not. I passed for lieutenant only last week, and a peace now would be monstrous unjust. It would mean..." At this point he became aware that he was prating to his elders, a practice discouraged in the service. He fell silent and pretended to be absorbed in the first red streaks of sunrise far ahead.
2 years ago, yes," said the accountant, taking no notice of him, "but not now, with the Continental Allies crumbling like dust and so much of our time and treasure taken up with this miserable, unnecessary, unnatural war with America. No, sir. I believe the rumours the gentlewoman's friends had heard were merely flim-flam, put about by evil-disposed men that wish to profit by the rise."
He went on to explain just why he thought Napoleon would never desire a negotiated peace at this juncture, and he was still speaking when the coach slowed to a halt and the guard cried, "All for the Jericho Ale House, gentlemen, if you please. Good fare for man and beast. Prime brandy, right old Nance, straight from the smuggler, and capital water straight from the well. Never mixed except by accident." A few minutes later, Stephen was standing there with his baggage by the side of the road, while the dim coach disappeared in a dust cloud of its own making, and a long trail of early morning rooks passed overhead. Presently the door of the alehouse opened, and an amiable slut appeared, her hair done up in little rags, very like a Hottentot, and her garment held close at the neck with one hand.
"Good morning now, Mrs. Comfort," said Stephen. "In time, pray, let the boy put these things behind the bar till I send for them. I mean to walk to Ashgrove over the fields."
"You'll find the captain there with some saucy foremast jacks and that wicked old Killick. But won't you step in, sir, and take a little something? It's a long, long way after a night in the coach."
Stephen knew that the Jericho could run to nothing more than tea or small beer, both equally repugnant to him in the morning. He thanked her and said he believed he should wait until he'd worked up an appetite. And when asked whether it would be that wicked old Killick who came in the cart for his portmanteau, he said he would make a point of asking the captain to send him. For the first mile, his road was a lane between high banks and hedges, with woods on the left hand and fields on the right. Well sprung wheat and hay, and the banks were starred all along with primroses, while the hedges had scores of very small, cheerful, talkative early birds, particularly goldfinches and their most brilliant plumage. And in the hay a corncrake was already calling. Then, when the flat land began to rise and fall, this lane branched out into two paths, the one carrying on over a broad pasture, a single piece of 50 or even 60 acres with some colts in it, and the other, now little more than a trace, leading down among the trees. Stephen followed the second. It was steep going, encumbered with brambles and dead bracken on the edge of the wood, and farther down with fallen branches and a dead tree or two. But near the bottom he came to a ruined keeper's cottage standing on a grassy plat, its turf kept short by the rabbits that fled away at his approach. The cottage had lost its roof long since, and it was filled tight with lilac, not yet in bloom, while nettle and elder had overwhelmed the outbuilding behind. But there was still a stone bench by the door, and Stephen sat upon it, leaning against the wall. Down here in the hollow the night had not yet yielded, and there was still a green twilight. An ancient wood. The slope was too great and the ground too broken for it ever to have been cut or tended, and the trees were still part of the primeval forest. Vast, shapeless oaks, often hollow and useless for timber, held out their arms and their young, fresh green leaves almost to the middle of the clearing, held them out with never a tremor, for down here the air was so still that gossamer floated with no perceptible movement at all. Still and silent, although far-off blackbirds could be heard away on the edge of the wood, and although the stream at the bottom murmured perpetually, the coombe was filled with a living silence. On the far side, high on the bank of the stream, there was a badger's holt. Some years ago Stephen had watched a family of fox cubs playing there, but now it seemed to him that the badgers were back. Fresh earth had been flung out, and even from the bench he could distinguish a well-trodden path. "Perhaps I shall see one," he said. And after a while his mind drifted away and away, running through a gloria he and Jack had heard in London, a very elaborate gloria by Frescobaldi. "But perhaps it's too late," he went on, when the gloria was ended and the light had grown stronger, a brighter green, almost the full light of dawn. Yet scarcely were these words formed in his mind before he heard a strong, rustling, sweeping, bumping sound, and a beautifully striped badger came into sight on the other side of the brook, walking backwards with a load of bedding under its chin. It was an old, fat badger, and it grumbled and cursed all the way. The last uphill stretch was particularly difficult, with the burden catching in hazel or thorn on either side and leaving long wisps. And just before the entrance, the badger lifted its head and looked round as though to say, "Oh, it's so bloody awkward." Then, having breathed, it took a fresh grip on the bundle and with a final oath vanished backwards into the holt. "Why do I feel such an intense pleasure, such an intense satisfaction?" asked Stephen. For some time he searched for a convincing reply, but finding none he observed, "The fact is that I do." He sat on as the sun's rays came slowly down through the trees, lower and lower, and when the lowest reached a branch not far above him, it caught a dewdrop poised upon a leaf. The drop instantly blazed crimson, and a slight movement of his head made it show all the colours of the spectrum with extraordinary purity, from a red, almost too deep to be seen, through all the others to the ultimate violet and back again. Some minutes later, a cock pheasant's explosive call broke the silence and the spell, and he stood up. At the edge of the wood, the blackbirds were louder still, and they'd been joined by blackcaps, thrushes, larks, monotonous pigeons, and a number of birds that should never have sung at all. His way now led him through ordinary country, field after field, eventually reaching Jack's woods, where the honey buzzards had once nested. But it was ordinary country raised to the highest power. The mounting sun shone through a faint veil with never a hint of glare, giving the colours a freshness and an intensity Stephen had never seen equalled. The green world and the gentle, pure blue sky might just have been created. And as the day warmed, 100 scents drifted through the air. Returning thanks at any length is virtually impossible, he reflected, sitting on a stile and watching two hares at play, sitting up and fibing at one another, then leaping and running and leaping again. How few manage even five phrases with any effect? And how intolerable are most dedications, too, even the best. Perhaps the endless repetition of flat, formal praise, for the Gloria was still running in his head, is an attempt at overcoming this, an attempt at expressing gratitude by another means. I shall put this thought to Jack, he said, having considered for a moment. The hares raced away out of sight, and he walked on, singing in a harsh undertone, Quoniam tu solus sanctus, tu solus dominus, tu solus altissimus, until a cuckoo called away on his left hand, cuckoo, cuckoo, loud and clear, followed by a cackling laugh, and answered by a fainter cuckoo, 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 far over on the right. His happiness sank at once. And he walked on with his head bowed and his hands clasped behind his back. He was now close to Jack's land. One more field and a lane, and then the ash grove woods began. On poor, spewy ground, with the vile lead mines and their ancient heaps of spoil among them. Then came Jack's plantations, dwarvish still, and much gnawed by rabbits, hares, deer, and a large variety of caterpillars. And at last the cottage came in sight. By now the day had woken up entirely to ordinary life. The silence had long since gone, and even if no cuckoo had called cuckold, there would still have been nothing left of that feeling of imminent miracle. It was now no more than an exceptionally pleasant summery day in spring. He was approaching the house from the back, and he saw it to no great advantage. Jack had bought the place when he was poor, and he'd enlarged it when he was rich. The result was an inharmonious jumble, with few of the advantages of a house and none of what meagre conveniences a cottage might have to offer. But at least it had glorious stables. Not only did Jack Aubrey love hunting the fox, but he was persuaded that he was as good a judge of horseflesh as any man in the Navy List. And when he came home from the Mauritius campaign, deep laden with prize money, he laid out a noble yard with a double coach house, an accommodation for hacks and hunters on one side, and a range of loose boxes to house the beginnings of a racing stable on the other, with tack rooms at the short ends, forming an elegant quadrangle of rosy brick trimmed with Portland stone and crowned by a tower with a blue-dialed clock in it. Stephen was not surprised to find the greater part shut up, since the hunters and the running horses had disappeared as soon as Jack's misfortunes began. But the absence of any other creatures, of the cart, and the low-slung gig in which Sophie went abroad was harder to understand. So when he came to it by way of the kitchen garden was the silence of the house. Jack had three children and a mother-in-law, and silence was unnatural. Yet never a sound emerged from the doors or windows, and an uneasiness came upon him, an uneasiness strengthened by the fact that all the doors and all the windows were open, and not only open but partly dismantled, which gave the house a blind, ravaged, gap-toothed, desolate air. The silence also reeked of turpentine, conceivably used as a disinfectant. He'd known plagues in which entire households were struck down overnight. The cholera morbus, too. God, between us and evil, he muttered. A cheer from far away changed the current of his mind, and some moments later this was followed by the peculiarly English sound of a bat striking a ball, and then by further cries. He passed quickly through what Jack called the rose garden, Lucus a non lucendo, through the shrubbery to the edge of the hill, and there below him on a broad meadow was a game of cricket, all laid out, the fielders in their places keenly attentive to the bowler as he went through his motions, the sound of the stroke again, the batsman twinkling between the wickets, fielders darting for the ball, tossing it in, and then the whole pattern taking shape again, a formal dance, white shirts on the green. He walked down the slope, and as he came nearer he recognised the players, or at least the batting side, and some of their opponents. Place and Bondon were in, and Captain Babington, formerly one of Jack's midshipmen, then one of his lieutenants, and now commander of the Tartarus, sloop of 18 guns, was bowling to his old shipmates as though he meant to carry their legs away as well as their stumps. For his part, Place was content to stop every straight ball and leave the rest alone. But Bondon had his eye well in, and he hit almost everything with equal fury. He'd scored 14 runs off the present over, and now the last ball came down, pitched rather short and outside the off stump. He gave it an almighty blow. But he'd misjudged the rise. And instead of skimming over the fielders' heads, the ball rose in a most surprising way, like a mortar bomb or a rocket, vanishing almost entirely. Three fielders ran in Stephen's direction, all gazing up and spreading their hands, while others called, "Heads! Heads!" or "Stand from under!" Stephen's mind was far away. He had noticed neither the stroke nor the flight of the ball, but one of the few things he had learnt at sea, learnt painfully and thoroughly, was that stand from under usually preceded, but only just preceded, a downpour of boiling pitch, or the fall of a very heavy block, or that of a needle-pointed marlin spike, and he hurried anxiously away, crouching, with his hands protecting his head. An unlucky move that brought him into collision with one fielder who was running backwards and with another already poised where the ball was about to come down. They fell in a confused heap from which he was extracted amidst cries of, "It's the doctor! Are you hurt, sir?" and "Why can't you look where you are coming to, you clumsy ox?" This to the Tartarus's yeoman of the sheets, who had held the catch in spite of everything and who rose through the welter of limbs, triumphantly holding it up. "Well, Stephen," said Jack, leading him to the refreshment cart after he'd been brushed down and put to rights with his wig set straight on his head, "so you've come down by the night coach, I find. How glad I am you found a place. I didn't look to see you till tomorrow, or I should have left a note. You must have been quite amazed to find the house all ahoo. Will you take a can of beer, or should you prefer cold punch?" "Would there be any coffee at all? I missed my breakfast." "Missed your breakfast? God's my life, how very shocking. Let's walk up and brew a pot. There are 5 wickets to fall, and Place and Killick will stick there like limpets. We've plenty of time." "Where's Sophie?" asked Stephen. "She's not here," cried Jack. "She's away, gone to Ireland with the children and her mother. Frances is having a baby. Ain't it amazing? I looked pretty blank when I reached the house and found no family at all, I can tell you. Nobody, and even old Bray down at the alehouse toping.
She had no idea we were in this hemisphere, even. But she's leaving the children and posting back directly. With any luck, we shall see her on Tuesday, or even Monday. I hope so, indeed. Lord Stephen, how I look forward to it, said Jack, laughing at the prospect. And then, after they'd been walking for a few moments, but in the meanwhile, here we are all a high loan, a parcel of poor, miserable bachelors. Luckily, the Tartarus is in to keep up our spirits, and there are so many old surprises here and in Pompey that by including the youngsters, and even your Padine, God help us, we were able to get up a team to play them. Although Mowat and Pullings had to go up to town to see the publisher, you only just missed them, which was a great pity, for two men in a higher state of nervous tremor I've never seen, and they would have profited from one of your comfortable slime draughts. Still, a team we have, and the Goat and Company's is going to send our dinner out to the field. You wouldn't believe how well the goat cooks venison. It eats as tender as veal. Look, Stephen, you see this corner of the wood and the shrubbery? I mean to cut the ground right back so that the new wing shall have a terrace and a fine stretch of grass. A lawn, if you understand me. I've always wanted a lawn. And perhaps I might be luckier with grass than with flowers. So there is to be a new wing? Oh, Lord, yes. We were most horribly cramped, you know. And with three children and a mother-in-law who often comes to stay, it was like living in a cutter, all hugger-mugger, cheek by jowl, 14 inches to a hammock, no more. And Sophie said that without more cupboards, she really couldn't go on. There's Dre turning into the yard. The gig, dear! The gig, ahoy! I sent him into Portsmouth for the newspapers. The gig wheeled about. How are we doing, sir? Cried the one-legged seaman as he drove in across the sacred gravel and handed out the Times, touching his forehead to Stephen with the other hand. 48 for 5, said Jack. We shall wipe Tartarus's eye with any luck. Come along now. I'll put the gig away. Dre fastened his wooden stump, unshipped for the drive, and pegged away down the slope as fast as ever he could go, for although his playing days were over, he was a most ardent critic. The gig itself scarcely needed putting away. It was attached to a very short-legged, short-sighted, deaf-meek animal of uncertain age, carefully chosen for Sophie, who feared and disliked horses as well she might, having been made to ride an iron-mouthed biter when she was far too young, and having seen various hunters break her husband's ribs and collarbones, while the running horses might have run off with her daughter's portions had the capital not been tied up. The present animal, Moses, walked quietly towards the yard, peering in its purblind way at Jack as he unfolded the Times to reach the financial page. Still reading, Jack opened the door of a palatial loose box. Stephen cast off the gig, Moses walked in, lay down, uttered a deep sigh and closed his eyes. "It's even better than I'd thought," said Jack. And his shining face was younger by a good 10 years. How I hope you profited by what I said. Shall I take notice of your advice? Replied Stephen with no particular emphasis. And Jack knew that he should learn no more. We shall certainly have a really spacious terrace. Perhaps with fountains. And there's a good deal to be said for a billiard room, too, on days when it's raining very hard, said Jack. He led the way to the kitchen, opened the door of the little stove and plied the bellows till the charcoal glowed almost white. You must forgive the smell of paint, he said, fetching down the coffee mill. We laid on the first coat yesterday. The rest of his words were drowned by the sound of grinding. They drank their grateful brew outside, walking up and down in the pure, soft air, while Stephen, an abstemious soul, ate two thin biscuits. When the pot was drunk, Jack cocked his ear to a roaring from the cricket field. "Perhaps we'd better be going down again," he said. And on the way, looking back in the narrow path, he said with a singularly sweet smile, "Did I tell you I mean to buy Surprise? She can moor in a private ordinary at Porchester." "Heavens, Jack! Is not this a very onerous undertaking?" I seem to remember that government gave £20,000 for the Chesapeake.
Yes, but that was mostly to encourage others to go and do likewise. Selling out of the service is another thing. I doubt Surprise will fetch anything like so much.
How does one set about buying a ship?
Well, you have to be there yourself with cash in hand. Well hit, sir, well hit!
Honey, a very dangerous crossbat smiter, had struck the ball in a high arc towards the approaching wagon from the Goat and Compasses. A wagon bearing the cricketer's dinner and drawn very deliberately by a pair of cows. Honey dealt with the next ball in much the same way, but a cunning Tartarus, the ship's corporal, and up to any guardo move, had lingered there. He caught the ball, Honey was out, the innings was over, and in an excess of gaiety the men unharnessed the cows and ran the wagon at breakneck pace to their respective captains.
"Padeen, now," said Stephen in Irish to his servant, a huge gentle monsterman with a great stutter and small knowledge of any other language. "And did you score a run at all?"
"I believe I did, sir dear. But then I ran back, and will it ever be counted to me? Who can tell?"
"Who indeed?" said Stephen, who had played the game once in the Spice Islands, but who had never quite mastered the finer points, nor for that matter the coarser ones either.
"Will your honour explain the Saxon game, perhaps?"
"I might," said Stephen. "When the venison pasty, and sure it is the venison pasty of the world, is finished, I will ask the little captain to tell me its whole nature, he having played for the gentlemen of Hampshire. And you are to understand that what Thomond is to the hurling, so Hampshire is to the cricket." The little captain was Babington, and he certainly knew a great deal about the game, but rarely would his shipmates, his former shipmates, his superior officer or his subordinates, allow him to finish a sentence of his explanation. The 7 pasties, the 10 apple pies, the unlimited bread and cheese, and the 4 kegs of beer might have been expected to have a deadening effect, but no. Every man there present, and even some of the beardless miscellaneous, such as youngsters and Marine Society boys, had particular views on the origins of cricket, on what constituted fair bowling, on the number of stumps in their grandfather's time, and the best way of using a bat. And one of Babington's own midshipmen quarrelled with his definition of a wide. Nobody contradicted Captain Ordinary, who in any case had gone to sleep leaning against the wheel of the cart with his hat over his face. But they wrangled so pertinaciously among themselves that Babington invited Stephen to walk round the field to be shown the positions of square leg, long stop and mid on. He soon dismissed the remaining points of fielding, and observed that tomorrow he hoped to show Stephen the difference between a slow, dead wicket and one upon which the ball would really turn. "You'll never play all this afternoon and all tomorrow too, for God's love!" cried Stephen, shocked out of civility by the thought of such insufferable tedium drawn out to such unconscionable length. "Oh, yes! It would have been a 3-day match, only with Mrs. Aubrey coming home the house must be turned out, swabbed and flogged dry, and the paintwork touched up. Still, with the long evenings, I dare say we shall each have our 2 innings. But, sir," said Babington, after a silence and in quite a different tone, "one of the many reasons I was so glad to hear from the captain that you was coming down was that I wanted to ask your advice."
"Ah," said Stephen.
In former times, this had usually meant a question of a medical nature. His companions at once persuaded the very young and costive Babington that he was going to have a baby, or a request for the loan of sums varying from 6 to as much as 0.5 guinea. But that was long ago, and now Babington had a considerable estate which included a parliamentary borough as rotten as a borough could well be, and it was no longer probable that he should think himself pregnant. "Well, the fact of the matter is, sir," said Babington, "and not to put too fine a point on it, I mean it's better to be plain, I dare say you remember that Admiral Hart cut up uncommon rough when he found me, well, kissing his daughter.
I remember he made use of some illiberal expressions. He did worse than that. He shut Fanny up and he beat her when he found we corresponded. And then he married her to Andrew Ray, swearing she should never go to a play or a ball unless she consented, and that anyhow I was pursuing the governor's daughter in Antigua. It was notorious. It was common knowledge. But, however, not to put too fine a point on it, the fact of the matter is, when I brought Dryad home, you remember Dryad, such a weatherly ship, we happened to meet at a ball, and we found that we were as fond of one another as ever, more so, if possible. "Listen, William, my dear," said Stephen, "if you wish me to advise you to commit adultery..." "No, no, sir," cried Babington, smiling. "No, I don't need any advice about adultery. My point is this, but perhaps I should explain the position. I dare say you know the Admiral was uncommon rich, and everyone said what a prodigious heiress Fanny would be and what a fine match for Ray. But what they didn't know was that he can scarcely get at a penny without her consent. And they don't agree, never have. How could they agree? As different as chalk and cheese. He's a wretched scrub of a fellow that drinks too much and cannot hold his wine, and he beats her. He told her openly he'd only married her for her money. It seems he's in debt up to the ears. The bailiffs are often in the house, and they have to be staved off by one shift or another. My visit must have been mighty importunate, reflected Stephen. But I'm not to be blackguarding the man, said Babington. My point is this. You saw a good deal of him in Malta, and you see farther through a brick wall than most people, so which do you think the wisest thing to do? There's the idea of making over some share of Fanny's fortune on the understanding that they keep up the appearance of being married, but in fact each go their own way. But I'm told that no contract to that effect would be binding, and he would have to be trusted. And then there is the idea of bolting and letting him sue me for crim con. For damages, for criminal conversation.
Sir, cried a youngster running up behind them. The captain's awake and asks, do you choose to start your innings now, since there'll be so much to do Saturday?
I shall come at once, said Babington. And in a low voice to Stephen, will you turn it over in your mind, sir, and tell me what you think? Although he knew that in cases of this kind, any advice that didn't exactly agree with the wishes of those concerned was always useless and often offensive, Stephen did turn it over in his mind all through that interminable afternoon while the Tartaruses built up their score, mainly in singles and byes. Their captain of the forecastle faced the bowling first, a square, middle-aged seaman who had been at the siege of Gibraltar in his youth, and who had never forgotten the value of dogged resistance. Neither he nor the carpenter was there for frivolous amusement, and they fairly broke the hearts of the bowlers, who sent down fast, straight balls, fast balls well outside the wicket, tempting lobs and cunning twisters, all in vain until the declining sun, shining in Gibraltar's eye, caused him to miss a despairing full toss directed at his middle stump. The next day's play was somewhat less rigid, with the Tartaruses leaving Jack's team 255 to get before Owl Hoot, and the Surprises beating the ball about the field in a brisk, seaman-like fashion, but by now it was too late. As far as Stephen was concerned, cricket was marked down forever as an intolerably insipid pastime, decorative enough for half an hour, perhaps, but not to be compared with hurling for speed, skill, grace of movement, and dramatic fire. This second day, however, was enlivened by the coming of Martin, thin and dusty, with having walked from Fareham to Portsmouth, and then from Portsmouth to Ashgrove. On leaving the Surprise for the village where lived the young lady he wished to marry, he'd forgotten that he needed Captain Aubrey's certificate of good conduct and moral behaviour before he could draw his pay. And Captain Aubrey, so rarely carrying a chaplain, had forgotten it too. Yet the money was most urgently required. "You cannot conceive, my dear Maturin," said Martin, reclining in a hammock chair at the edge of the field with a glass of brandy and ginger ale on the grass beside him and his certificate glowing in his lap. or perhaps you can, but I couldn't, having always lived in lodgings. You cannot conceive what it costs to set up house. We're only to have a cottage quite close to her father's rectory, so that she'll not be lonely when I'm at sea, yet also conveniently near one of the best places for thick-kneed plover you can imagine. But furnishing it with the simple necessities, heavens above! The outlay in patty-pans, andirons, marketplace delphin, common green-handled knives alone is enough to make a man turn pale. To say nothing of brooms, pails and washing-tubs, it's a very grave responsibility. I feel it much. Stephen had already welcomed Martin, had led him up to the house for food and wine, and had given him joy of his approaching marriage. Now, having listened to the exorbitant price of coppers, cheese graters, and a number of other domestic objects for a long while, he said, "Should you like to see a lesser petty chap's on her nest, not half a mile from here?" "To tell you the truth, Maturin, on a perfect vernal day like this, I find nothing so pleasant as sitting on a comfortable chair in the sun with green, green grass stretching away, the sound of bat and ball and the sight of cricketers, particularly such cricketers as these. Did you see how Maitland glanced that ball away to leg? A very pretty stroke. Don't you find watching good cricket restful, absorbing, a balm to the anxious, harassed mind?" "I do not. It seems to me, saving your presence, unspeakably tedious. Perhaps some of the finer shades may escape you." "Well played, sir! Oh, very well played indeed. That was as pretty a late cut as ever I've seen. How they run! Oh, he was very nearly out. See how the bales fly! But he was just within his ground. It's years since I've seen such a serious game of cricket." "This one is serious enough for all love, nay, funereal. You know Sir Joseph Banks, of course?" "The great chum of botany, sure I know him, since he's the president of the Royal Society. He was at the same school as I, though of an earlier generation. He often came down to watch us, and once he told me that cricket was played regularly in heaven. And that, from a man with his attainments, is surely a recommendation. I must draw what comfort I can from the doctrine of limbo." "Butterfingers!" cried Martin, as Midon dropped to catch and fumbled for the ball behind him. The batsman beckoned for the run. Midon whipped round and threw down the wicket with diabolic force and speed. "Oh, the dog!" said Martin. "Oh, the artful hound!" And when the cheering, hooting and calling out had stopped, he went on, "I was so very sorry to have missed Mowat. This publisher wishes him to bring the book out by subscription, and I'd hoped to tell him something of the disadvantages of such a method. Nothing can easily exceed the misery of going about among one's acquaintance with a subscription list and desiring them to put down half a guinea. I wish to warn him against the man, too. He's tolerably notorious in Grub Street, I find. And I'm afraid sailors ashore are not always as cautious as they should be, considering the rapacious duplicity of certain landsmen." After some more considerations of this kind, Martin undertook to make Stephen love cricket by showing him the finer shades. But when, having endured 10 overs more, Stephen found that there were still 5 men to go in and be got out, he observed that he had seen a wry-neck over on the far side of the domain, and he made no doubt it was still there. Yet even this wouldn't move Martin, who said, "A wry-neck? Yes, they call him the cuckoo's mate in these parts, and the cuckoo is here. Dear me, yes, hear them, 3 at least. Cuckoo, cuckoo. Oh, word of fear, unpleasing to a married ear. Lord, and to think I shall be a husband in a fortnight's time. Pitch it up, man, pitch it up, or you'll never get him out. Long hops are no good to man or beast." The afternoon was even more perfect than the morning, and Stephen spent much of it wandering in Jack's woods and meadows. He visited the lesser petty chaps and many another bright-eyed bird, including a hen pheasant sitting hard, and a goshawk with a silver bell on her leg perched on a branch that looked at him doubtfully as he passed. He had plenty of time to reflect on Babington's situation, and he did so, but to no purpose.
In the evening, when, as Martin had predicted, the match ended in a draw, he said, "William, I'm sorry to say I have nothing positive or even moderately intelligent to offer. It has, of course, occurred to you that an injured husband in the Admiralty itself is capable of hurting a sea officer's career. Yes. And I have weighed it pretty carefully. But, you know, my cousins and I can certainly rely on 5 and probably on 7 votes in the Commons. And that is where support for the Ministry really counts at present, rather than in the Lords. So I think that cancels out. You know more about these things than I do, sure. The only other observation I have to offer is that it is probably unwise to trust any man you do not know very well, above all a man who dislikes you. I don't say this against Ray in particular, I only throw it out as a generality. A generality worthy of La Palice, I must confess. I was sure you'd be in favour of our bolting, cried Babington, shaking his head. I am nothing of the kind, said Stephen. I always knew you were the best headpiece in the service, and I shall tell Fanny so when I bring Tartarus home. She is on the breast blockade, I correct. Yes, and we sail on Monday, alas, unless there's some reprieve. You'll miss Sophie. I'm afraid so, more's the pity, but at least we shall be able to lend a hand in getting the place ready for her. Stephen had seen Captain Aubrey, his officers and men, getting their ship ready for an admiral's inspection. But he hadn't seen Jack preparing the house for the return of a dearly loved, long-absent wife. It was an impressive sight. And all the more so because Jack was increasingly aware that Sophie might be very bitterly offended against him. He was nervous, apprehensive, deprecating. In ships of the Royal Navy, painting went on nearly all the time when the weather would allow it, while in those which made a clean sweep fore and aft at quarters, as did all Jack's commands, the carpenters, their crews, and the captain's joiners took it as a matter of course that all the bulkheads, all the internal walls, together with the accurately fitted doors and lockers, should be taken down every evening and put up again an hour or so later. Jack, therefore, had very highly skilled labour at his disposal, and not only his own people either, but all the best Tartarians and 2 expert joiners from Portsmouth as well. And on Wednesday they'd set about the house, removing every door, shutter and window, scraping them, rubbing them down and laying on the first coat. Now the second coat of a quick-drying naval paint could go on, followed by the massive cleaning of everything in sight, so that late on Sunday the principal rooms could be restored to use, and the rest on Monday morning. Meanwhile, hammocks had been slung in the loose boxes and the coach house filled with furniture. "You'll not mind turning out rather early tomorrow, Stephen," said Jack that night. "With a little extra time, I believe, we may take up the flagstones in the hall, kitchen, scullery and pantry, and grind them to a good fresh white, squaring their angles and giving them a true surface. It was Babington's idea. His captain of the hold was once a master stone dresser, and he says all we need is a bear, a staging, and 1/2 a bushel of Purbeck grit." Stephen had grown used to extreme discomfort at sea or in any other place where the Navy carried its Hebraic notions of ritual cleanliness, but never had he experienced anything to touch the desolation of Ashgrove Cottage shortly after the various working parties had moved in at dawn. Now all the doors and windows were out, made fast by dowels to an ingenious system of lines in the stable yard that allowed both sides the maximum of sun and air, and throughout the house there was the sound of sluicing water, violent scrubbings and thumping, and strong nautical cries, which strengthened the impression that the place had been boarded and carried by storm. In spite of the celestial weather, the cottage was like something between a manufactory, a waterworks, and a house of correction with the inmates put to hard labour. And Stephen was glad to get away from it, driving Martin to Portsmouth in the gig there to take the Salisbury coach. Once removed from cricket, Martin became a reasonable companion again, and they took particular delight in the whin chats and wheat ears on Portsdown, and in the middle spotted woodpecker eating ants like its great green cousin, which neither had seen before. But once they were in the town, the future husband tended to predominate. He drew a list from his pocket and said, 1 conical gravy strainer, 1 bottle jack and crane, 3 iron spoons, 1 jelly bag indifferent big. You'll not mind if we look into an ironmonger's margarine. Now that I'm sure of my pay, I believe I may venture upon a copper gravy strainer and a brass bottle jack. But it's a consequential purchase, you know, and I should be most grateful for your advice. Stephen's advice on bottle jacks was of no great value, but he gave it for rather more than half a wavering undecided hour, he having a sincere regard for Martin. Yet, well-founded though it was, his affection wouldn't run to discussing the merits of different kinds of copper-bottom tin-bodied well kettles for an equal length of time. He left Martin with the ironmonger's kind and infinitely patient wife, and stepped across the street to a silversmith's, where he bought a teapot, cream jug and sugar bowl as a wedding present. Returning with the parcel, he found Martin now divided between 2 pewter freezing pots of slightly different size and quality, and said, "I beg you and your bride will accept these with my love." "Oh," said Martin, astonished, "oh, thank you very much. May I look?" "You'll never be able to do it up again, pretty," said Stephen. "I'll wrap it up for the gentleman," said the ironmonger's wife eagerly. "Upon my word, Maturin," cried Martin, holding up the pot, "this is extremely handsome in you. I take it very, very kindly. Polly'll be so delighted, bless you." "Now, sir, what are you thinking of?" said the silversmith angrily, running into the shop. "If Bob hadn't seen you step into Mrs. Westby's, what should I have looked like? Jack pudding, that's what. Now, sir, just you count with me," he went on emphatically, putting down the notes and coins he was carrying one by one. "And 5 is 17, which makes £17.4 and 3 change at your service." He ended quite sharply with a meaning look at Mrs. Westby, who pursed her lips and shook her head. Stephen put what face he could upon it, but this was not his day. The re-wrapping of the pot and the packing of the ironmongery took so long that they had to run furiously for the Salisbury coach, hallooing to make it pause. It did take Martin up, but as it bowled fast and faster still away, already somewhat late, Stephen noticed that the hand he was waving still held the medium-sized jelly bag. Slowly he and Moses made their way back to Ashgrove Cottage, and the evening light showed it even more ravaged than before, because by now the entire hall, kitchen and all that lay beyond on the ground floor had been eviscerated. Where neat stone had been, the startled eye now saw dank, malodorous earth, like a battlefield, with pools of water traversed by planks. The flags themselves were being ground on the staging in groups of 6, with 4 powerful seamen heaving the double-weighted bear to and fro, with a 5th standing on it, laughing, sprinkling Purbeck grit and directing the jet of water, while 200 years of patina ran away down a neat channel into Jack's asparagus bed. The whole garden was crisscrossed with planks over wet sailcloth, and great amorphous objects stood here and there in the twilight, veiled by still more sailcloth, this time dry. "Oh, Stephen," cried Jack on seeing his disconsolate face, "I cannot tell you how pleased I am with the flags. They've taken a little longer than I thought, and I'm afraid they may not all be finished tonight, but we've already floored part of the back scullery. Come and see. There, ain't that prime? It's as neat as a chessboard," said Stephen, raising his voice over the thunder of swabs flogging the boards dry overhead. "Sophie'll be amazed," said Jack. "Come and see the grinding stage." Work on the grinding stage had stopped, however. The 4 heavers stood with their ropes slack, the 5th man was fixed in mid-caper, and his water dribbled idly as he too gaped at the post-chaise. Jack followed their gaze, and his stern, impatient eye looked straight into Sophie's face. Her expression, incredulous, appalled, instantly changed to open delight. He plucked her out, kissed her most heartily, and began to explain what they were at. Everything shipshape tomorrow, paint dry, flags laid. They'd found a disused well in the passage. How are the children? While at the same time, in a rapid voice, the words bubbling over one another, she told him of her excellent crossing. Nothing at all, slept all the way. Obliging civil people at the inns, kind postboys, children and mamma all well, Frankie and her baby too, a boy. Mr. Clotworthy delighted, how lovely to be home. She then recovered her wits, and averting her eyes from the wreck of her house, she shook Babington's hand, embraced Stephen tenderly, greeted all the officers, young gentlemen and seamen she knew, and said she wouldn't get in their way, would go and sort her baggage and draw breath in one of the loose boxes. There was nothing she preferred to a really commodious loose box. It was in this loose box, which had once sheltered Jezebel, Jack's candidate for the Oaks, that they ate their supper, lit by a stable lantern. They had, if not a vast stretch of time, then at least a very great number of events to communicate, and they were rarely silent. One of the difficulties was to know just how much had already been told by letter, which letters had arrived and which had miscarried. "The very last I had from you," said Jack. And as he spoke, he realised that he was running fast into uncharted, shoaling water. However, there was no help for it now, and in a somewhat constrained voice he went on, looking at his plate, "Was in Barbados. A copy of one you sent to Jamaica too, I believe." "Oh, yes," cried Sophie, "the one that kind, attentive young man offered to carry. And so he found you, then. I'm so glad, my dear." She looked at him, hesitated, and then flashing a little, she went on, "I thought him so particularly amiable, all one could wish in a young man, and very much hope he'll give us a long visit as soon as ever his duties allow. I should very much like the children to know him." By 11 o'clock on Monday morning, the last pieces of the disrupted pattern fell into place. An Ashgrove cottage, new painted, new floored, its brass glass pump handles and all metalwork gleaming with a somewhat aggressive naval cleanliness, looked very much as Jack had wished Sophie to see it when she arrived. At noon, Babington's men were regaled with roast beef and plum duff, and then packed, reasonably sober, into two wagons to take the Tartarus to sea on the evening tide. And now Jack was leading Sophie about the wood beyond the shrubbery to show her the improvements he had in mind. "This is the path that Stephen calls the Boreen," he observed. "He had some very strange expressions, poor dear fellow. How I hope I didn't offend him by taking notice of his way of saying Cato. Sometimes he's a little touchy." Stephen had driven into Portsmouth on Sunday to hear Mass in a Romish chapel there, and he hadn't reappeared, only sending Pardeen back with a message to the effect that he found himself obliged to go to London and begged to be excused. "I'm sure you didn't, my dear," said Sophie. She was morally certain that Stephen found her deeply affectionate sympathy more painful than any other, and she was wondering how this could be phrased, or, indeed, whether it could be said at all, when they saw Killick hurrying towards them from the house. Killick was perfectly used to having the captain pursued for debt and to foiling the bums, and there was a concerned, intelligent, knowing look on his face that instantly brought some of these episodes to mind. "Is it the bailiffs?" asked Jack. "It's a rum curry, sir," said Killick, "more like a gent. And, sir," he said in a low, anxious voice behind his hand, "it's no good tipping him to go by. There's a party of heavyweight coves each end of the lane and behind, and they look precious like Bow Street runners." "I'll deal with him," said Jack, smiling. And he walked into the house. There he found a calm, self-possessed man with a folded paper in his hand. "Good day, sir," he said. "I'm Captain Aubrey. What may I do for you?" "Good day to you, sir," replied the man.
Might we step into a private room? I've been sent from London on a matter that affects you most particularly. Very well, said Jack, opening a door. Please to mind the paintwork. Now, sir, what is this matter you're speaking about? I'm concerned to say that it is a warrant for your arrest. The devil it is! At whose suit? It's not an arrest for debt, sir. It's an arrest by warrant. On what charge? Asked Jack, amazed. Conspiracy to defraud the stock exchange. Oh, is that all? Said Jack with great relief. Good Lord, I can very easily explain my dealings with them. I'm sure you can, sir, but in the meanwhile I must ask you to come with me. I trust you'll not make my duty more unpleasant than it has to be. I trust you'll not oblige me to place a gentleman of your quality under restraint. If you'll give me your word not to attempt an escape, I'll delay the execution of this warrant for half an hour so that you may make your arrangements. But then we must set off for London. I have a carriage waiting at the door.